Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we've got some good stuff going for you tonight. You might say the show is going to the dogs, and I'll get more into that here in a second. Of course, we have to go to the dogmeister herself, Sam Bradley.
That would be me, and I've got a house full of them right now, but hopefully they'll stay quiet. Things are actually kind of warming up out here in Colorado, which is really kind of nice. We've been having our afternoon thunderstorms pretty much every day, but the good thing there is I don't have to water the lawn. So there you go. Becky DePodwin, meteorologist extraordinaire. Any severe storms this week? Anything exciting going on for the nation?
You know, not as bad as it has been. That was a pretty brutal couple of weeks we had there. Still some severe storms on the high plains, you know, Texas Panhandle, New Mexico going on, as well as the upper Midwest, actually, ongoing right now. Maybe some severe storms in the Ohio Valley into the Mid-Atlantic tomorrow. Maybe you'll get some in Indiana, Joe. Not sure. More southern Indiana. I'm not sure where you are. And then finally, some good news is some rain for the southeast. They've had very little rain for the last 2 months, so they've been baking and getting no rain. Unfortunately, on the flip side, still a lot of river flooding happening, major to moderate or moderate to major flip that flooding. Record flooding expected on the Arkansas River, and St. Louis River is expected to have the second all-time highest crest. So still a lot going on in the middle of the nation in terms of flooding, some severe storms, but overall a quieter weather pattern than we've had the last couple of weeks.
You know, and Becky, I noticed that this isn't U.S. weather, but I noticed that they're having extreme heat going on in India and parts of Central Asia. Temperatures of 50 degrees Celsius, which is what, over 120 degrees Fahrenheit?
Yeah, it's been brutal there. Hopefully getting some relief with the system that's coming through parts of Europe right now. But they're kind of right in the middle of two storm systems right now. But yeah, you're right. It's been really, really brutal start to the season in that part of the world.
I can't even imagine heat like that. Oh, my God. Well, we have Dr. Joe, and Dr. Joe is doing something rather exciting in a place in Indiana that I can't pronounce. Joe, you want to tell us a little bit about what you're doing?
Sure. Hi, everybody. So I am in central Indiana at a large high-fidelity training center where we're having an operational readiness exercise that involves multiple task forces from the federal USAR system, lots of state and regional assets, and even some international USAR teams from Australia and two or three from Canada. So the purpose of this exercise is honestly to do not only sort of the usual kind of training that we do, but this one really has a focus on the international component with the idea of familiarizing each side of the international relationship, how we would bring in international teams into the U.S. in the event of a really large catastrophic event like a New Madrid earthquake and that sort of stuff. So had some great couple of days with, again, the Australians and Canadians and kind of getting them familiar with how things work and how the U.S. system works, learning some great stuff from each other and some great exchanges of bling and a big trading fest. So we've had a great week here so far.
Joe, what's the biggest challenge with them? Is it do they use anything akin to our incident command system so that it's kind of something that can kind of translate well, or is this something that really requires some effort to integrate?
I think the general approach is pretty similar. They're all INSOROC, style task forces, so. Based on some international standards, there's enough similarities in structure and in the administrative side of things that they can fit in quite easily. It really for them is letting them sort of know a bit more of the nuances of how we do things here versus how they do things there. So, for example, the Australian team covers the entire continent of Australia, and they are equipped with six C-130 aircraft, which fly them all over the country, right? And, you know, in the U.S., the ability to get military airlift is a rather arduous task in many cases. And so just sort of familiarizing them with the fact that, you know, they've got planes sitting at the airport that belong to them and they can do whatever they need to with. For us, it's not quite that easy. And we have to rely on our military partners to take care of that. So it's a lot of just little subtle things that you wouldn't think much about, but that in a large scale incident could make a lot of frustrations and easy to confuse each other on terminology and who do I talk to get access to this resource, et cetera. So lots of little stuff like that that we just want to kind of talk through and work through so that in the event that those teams are ever deployed here in the U.S., they are at least prepared for how to deal with those subtle differences between the two systems.
Well, it's great that you're being proactive about it now. The time to do that is not when the quake happens.
Well, you're exactly right, Sam. Cool. Yeah, that's exactly what the whole purpose of this exercise is all about.
And conversely, should something major happen in their countries, like you said, it might be a little harder to get there, but we'd be more ready to jump in and do the job, right? And this is a week long, Joe?
Yeah, it's going on for about a week.
Perfect. Well, we have to mention you have your wife, Kimberly, there with you, even though she's tied up in the moment and hopefully can join us in a bit. But, you know, she is becoming a dog trainer and she's just short of being certified to deploy. True?
That is correct. She's been able to join the task force here for some introductory training herself and has been working with some of the other handlers, dogs and that sort of thing. And I think is having a great time, quite honestly. And of course, it's wonderful to see her enjoying herself and really enjoying the experience for the first time.
Well, it's neat that she can be there with you and be into what you're doing. That's extremely cool. How's her dog training going?
The dog training is going well. Both dogs are progressing along, and she hopes to test one of them in the near future and another one probably into the summer.
Beautiful. Well, speaking of dogs, that's an excellent segue. We're talking dogs tonight, and Joe has a cohort that has worked with him on the IST, and she is a vet and a dog trainer, and she's going to tell us more about that. So, Joe, do you want to introduce Lori?
Well, I'll be happy to introduce Dr. Lori Gordon, who is a longtime friend and a veterinarian extraordinaire, as well as you know, heavily involved on the dog training side also. But Lori has been in the USAR system for a number of years as a veterinary surgeon and comes out with the IST pretty frequently to help us manage the large number of SAR dogs that are out in the field. And so I want to introduce Lori and ask her to tell us a little bit more about her background and et cetera. So, Lori, welcome to the podcast. We're really glad to have you.
Well, thank you very much. I started out about, I first deployed actually to the World Trade Center, and that was with the old Veterinary Medical Assistance Team, which has since changed over to the National Veterinary Response Team, and that's where I learned about urban search and rescue in FEMA, and I joined the Mass Task Force that January, and I never left. So they were kind enough to take me in, even though there was no veterinary position officially on the team. And I worked to get a veterinary position recognized by FEMA so they could be covered by liability and workman's comp. We got that. Politics took about 7 years, but it was a good experience for me. And then I've been deploying either with my task force or for FEMA on the IST ever since.
Fantastic. Well, we certainly enjoyed working with you in the field, and I want to open it up to some questions from my compatriots here about your different experiences.
Well, and Joe, I kind of wanted you and Lori to talk about where you have worked together on the IST and how does that work with doctor oversight and vet oversight. So, Lori, I'll jump on that one.
Well, the last time I saw Dr. Hawley was at Hurricane Michael down in Florida,
he was actually deployed with his team, and I was deployed on the IST, and Tennessee Task Force One hosted me, gave me a place to stay and rest in between my my bouts out in the field. So that was really great. So I basically used them as a base and worked to give veterinary care or advice or help anybody out while the dogs were out. I would go from place to place where they were working, team to team, or answer radio calls, including Tennessee, and treated any dogs that needed treatment.
Very good. How many vets do they usually have on an incident, or does it depend on the size of the incident?
So that is a very interesting question. So there is
we have Lori.
Yes. So there, in the FEMA system, there's 28 teams across the nation, and there's actually only myself and one other veterinarian, Dr. Jennifer Brown from Florida, too, that are IST or incident support team veterinarians. I've been trying to recruit some for a very long time, but it's quite a commitment. So it takes a lot out of a person's life. My practice is just me, so whenever I want to deploy, I just ask myself, and I usually say yes. As a matter of fact, I always say yes.
That works.
Well, obviously, my family, husband, and kids have a piece of that, but they're pretty generous and independent. So I did form what I call the USAR Veterinary Group. It's just a website of information, and I have some veterinarians throughout the country that also, their teams are very generous, and I'll allow them to deploy or work with their own individual state or federal task forces. I'm still working on getting them to join the IST, but right now there's just two of us. The other one, Dr. Brown, is also a canine handler for her team, so she often deploys as a canine handler but also functions as a veterinarian. My dog is trained in human remains detection with other organizations, so she doesn't deploy with me.
Yeah, I want to talk more about your dog, but Jamie, you had a question.
Yeah, I'm just curious, what kind of, you know, in a given event like Michael, for instance, this past mm-hmm. year, what kind of injuries were common, or what kind of situations did you see with the dogs that required some treatment or management on your part?
I saw two main things. One was medical and one was injury. One was illness, one was injury, and that's the heat. It was easily 90 degrees and 80 to 90% humidity almost every day we worked. And so you have to take special care. Some of these search dogs are acclimated and some are not. And if you want a search dog to last through an 8 to 10-hour shift, you have to mitigate their work. You can't work them for an hour. They're going to collapse. So you work them in little bits, and you take little parts of where they're asked to search. So they, in that kind of heat and humidity, they may work for 5 minutes and rest for 15. But by doing that, rehydrating them and cooling them off by pouring water over them, getting them in the shade, by doing that, they can do the whole day. But if you try to get it all done in one bout, they're going to collapse. So the handlers, for the most part, their education and knowledge about heat stress is greatly improved over the years. And I saw handler care for their dogs was really terrific. It's a little less with new handlers. And so I'm there to kind of help them out, say, and if they need fluids, if they're dehydrated, but definitely that work-rest cycle in that kind of heat, maybe 5 minutes work, 15 to 20 rest. Whereas if you were a 60 degrees, no humidity, cloud cover, they may be able to work 15 to 30 minutes with only a 10 to 15 minute rest. So that was one thing in Michael on the potential illness side. The injury side was definitely paw pad wounds. It was so hot, and they were going over some really rough debris that many of them had, their paw pads would just wear away down to bleeding. And so for their mission is to search, and I have a, when I deployed to the Oso landslide, we developed a 6-7 layer bandage that would take care of wounds, provide padding, and last for the day. It's a lot of padding to allow for swelling of the feet, as well as the medication for the injury, and then layer after layer, and finally the top layer is actually duct tape, but it's so much padding underneath that any swelling won't cause a loss of blood supply to the feet. So I did that. Some of the dogs had bandages on 2, 3, even 4 feet, and that allowed them to search. Even though they had pad wounds, it took care of it, so they could do that without any pain or lameness. So puncture wounds, scrapes, and wearing away of the paws was the most common injury.
Lori, that was a big issue at Ground Zero, wasn't it? The heat, and I know I was there, so the heat in the ground stayed there for quite a long time, and I know that was an issue for the dogs. How did they handle it there?
At the World Trade Center?
Correct.
So the World Trade Center, the weather varied a little bit when I was there that first week, but yes, there were fires and smoke, and so a lot of bandages. I had one dog, instead of wearing away of the paw pads, it was more lacerations. I had one canine come in to the Javits Center, and I told the handler, I can fix this. I'm going to bandage it. It'll last you one shift. It's going to fall apart because it's a paw pad, and when that does, come back, and I'll fix it again. But you're going to need to redo this for every shift, and he did, and it was great. The dog did great.
Perfect. Joe, did they use a lot of dogs at the Pentagon at the same time?
Yeah, we certainly had a fair number of dogs at the Pentagon, and saw many of the same issues that Lori saw there. Of course, a lot of the work in the Pentagon was inside of a building, so we were at least shaded from sun and that sort of stuff. Even though it was certainly hot there, we didn't quite have the dramatic exposure that the Trade Center folks did.
Wow. I wanted to go to Becky. Do you have any questions or thoughts so far, Becky? You're an animal person.
No, the animal and weather combination is something I can't say. It's so obvious, but I just had never thought of the impact of the weather on the rescue animals after a disaster. You always think of, humans without air conditioning after a disaster. But what about the pets? And that's always why we say, make sure you include your pets in your preparation plans. So obviously the rescue animals, I think you guys take amazing care of, but also a good thing to the public that keep in mind, if you're without AC after a disaster, you got to make sure your pets are taken care of as well. So that's the 5 minutes working, 15 minutes rest can probably be somewhat applicable to, pets being outside generally after a disaster like that.
Well, it's really nice after Katrina, when they got formed the Pets Act, so that we can legally rescue animals as long as there aren't humans taking precedence. And so also a lot of regional and local rescue teams have popped up. National Veteran Response Team is the federal one. So my mission with the team is to take care of the search dogs, but if someone brings us a pet, we will and have taken care of them, and then we transport them out to a facility that is set up to take care of the pets and strays that may be picked up. Sometimes the task forces rescue animals that have no owners. That was Matthew 2-3 years ago in North Carolina. So we had a whole bunch of rescued animals and eventually got them to places where they could be taken care of.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. I think that pets program, we talked a little about that. Yeah, it's a really good thing. So tell us about your dog.
Gavner Abigail. She is 9.5 years old. She's an Australian Shepherd mix. She is certified when she was 2.5, 3 years old in with the International Police Working Dog Association and is certified three more times with them every 2 years in crime scene. Crime scene is HR in a fire scene, a building, vehicle search, and then a one-acre land search. She's disaster certified with NSDA, which is the National Search Dog Association. So what that allows me to do is take her with me in the plane as a certified search dog. She mainly, other than doing some searches, mainly is my demo dog to teach human medical personnel canine first aid in the field. You have to remember, only three or four of our task forces have veterinarians on the team in another capacity because there is no official position for them on the team. So the human medics are actually primarily responsible for at least the initial triage of any searched canine who's considered a team member to take care of. So I am involved along with others in the medical specialist course, and usually the last day is devoted to canine care. And Davner is a very good demo model. She's thin, you can feel her pulses. She'll lie down with a pulse ox on her lip and EKG pads on her paws and someone bandaging her all at the same time. So she's a really good demo dog for that.
God, I love that name. That's very cool. But if she's 9 years old, how many more years do you think she can work? Or is it just kind of wait and see?
It is a wait and see because she may be 9.5 years old, but she zooms around like a 2 or 3 year old. You would never know it. So I prefer, there are certainly general age things. Most handlers will get a second dog if they're going to continue in search when their dog is 5, 6, 7, or 8 years old, and they will start training another one in anticipation that it takes 18 months minimal to 3 years to even initially certify a dog. And by that time, the dog will be 8, 9, or 10. I've seen some dogs at 10 that look 12 and others at 10 that look 5. So it really depends on the dog. It's nature and nurture. It's genetics as well as their care. So you really have to go on an individual basis.
Well, Aussies are amazing. I've had a couple of them, and they just don't quit. They go on forever.
Actually, yep, she is. I got her on PetFinder.com.
Really? No kidding?
Yeah, she was. No kidding. She was going to be just my hiking buddy, but my canine coordinator on the Mass Task Force, who is also a veterinarian, Dr. Janet Merrill, she said, Lori, you really ought to train a dog. It'll make you a better search dog veterinarian. And that would also get her another live fine dog in the task force, of course. But Davy is not high drive enough for live find. Live find, when you're looking for someone who's alive, it needs to be quick. It needs to be high drive search. So Davy's a little quieter. She thinks a lot. She kind of takes her time. So we switched her over to human remains, and she's done very well with that.
Well, that's where I learned to love Aussies, because they used them on the ski patrol I was with for many years.
And oh, yeah.
I used to be the one that to go hide in the snow so they could come find me. And it was just amazing to watch them scent on a wide scale and then gradually narrow it. I mean, their process was just really amazing. So I've had Aussies ever since. Yeah. So is Dabney only certified to do human remains because of what you were just talking about?
She is. Now, FEMA prefers that your search dog be single purpose, just either live find or just HR. But I know that New York Task Force 1, they're half their team are firefighters and half their team are police or law enforcement. And law enforcement canines are dual trained. They will do, for example, their police job, which may be patrol, it may be drugs or firearms. But they will also do live finder HR. So they may be dual. They're often dual purpose. Some of them do live find in HR. And dogs certainly can be trained that way. FEMA prefers a single-use dog, but there are many dogs who do multiple search venues. Search is very similar, whether it is bed bugs or bombs or live finds, humans or human remains, because you teach the dog to prefer a certain odor over anything else. You only reward them for that particular thing. But there are some of them are certainly smart enough to be able to distinguish several scent odors, several scent purpose.
Well, yeah, because I was thinking about police dogs and the fact that they do any number of things. And a thought just came into my head when you were talking. I watched that Border Wars show where they show the dogs that search the cars for narcotics and what have you. And they try to put hot dogs in their stash so the dog, you know, will be dissuaded to smell the narcotics, I suppose.
Yeah,
doesn't seem to work. They've actually trained them to ignore hot dogs. So.
Oh, yes, yes. Davy gets hot dogs or other animal bones that are distractors. And if she, so in her younger days, if she'd get all excited, ooh, there's chicken in there, I want it, and she'd bark, her bark wasn't the same as it is for human remains. And I never reward her. I just walk away and ignore her. And that's how we teach a dog, oh, I'm not getting rewarded for barking at this scent, and I'm not getting reward for barking at that scent. I'm only getting my reward if I bark at human remains. Human remains, actually, you need to do, not to be gross, but you need to do fresh tissue, you need to do decomposed tissue, you need to do bones, frozen stuff, you need to do it. High up, like in a tree or high up in a building, and you need to do buried in the earth, burned, cremations. I mean, there's such a variety, but they get it. There's a something in that human remain sense that triggers their response. But no, when she barks at chicken, she doesn't get anything, and she learned pretty quick that she might as well forget it.
Yeah, they're pretty smart. But I have to ask, how does one acquire the human remains you need to train the dog?
Well, initially, we use a lot of placenta, so there isn't a chain of custody about actual human remains. Placentas are donated because they're not considered part of that custody, that chain of custody that a medical examiner needs to follow up or the state needs to follow up. It is just donated as waste. And others are donated, people who donate their bodies for science. Some do it specifically for search. Others are acquired through a medical examiner's office. It all has to be documented. In other words, you know, and everything needs to be respected. We don't use anything with an identifying mark like a tattoo, or they're just parts of bodies that are unidentifiable. And there are some schools or institutions, teaching institutions for human medical that get these donated bodies specifically for teaching search.
Wow. So as to not take over the conversation here, which I've been doing. Joe, any thoughts or questions from you?
Well, not necessarily a question, just sort of follow along with the line of discussion there related to the tissue necessary to train the HR dogs. We do a lot of that as well through through our contacts, and I'll just add to what Lori said already that there's a vetting process for those that are receiving tissue. To ensure that it's, you know, treated respectfully and appropriately, and that it's coming from appropriate sources and being utilized in the right way with all the appropriate safeties in place to ensure respect and et cetera for those donated remains.
Well, and Joe, for you, it's not unlike you guys dealing with your cadaver folks for training. And you're very serious about respecting the dead, and you know the people that have devoted their bodies to training, and you make that very clear to the students.
Absolutely, and it's certainly no different for, you know, the training that we would do with the dogs as well.
Perfect. Jamie, thoughts from you?
No, it's all very fascinating, and, you know, it's one of those aspects, I think, that we don't really think about in the midst of all of our other discussions on disaster response, disaster training, is that, you know, these are essential partners to the process. I think Joe and Lori would both agree with that without our search partners and our search animals, that we wouldn't be able to do the things that are being done following these major events.
And they truly are a part of the team, like Lori alluded to, like just like police dogs are actual officers, and they're treated as such. Becky, any thoughts from you?
No, nothing right now. Just really enjoying hearing this. Also, I love Australian Shepherds. If I ever get a dog, it's probably going to be some mix of that.
There you go.
So, Lori,
go ahead, John.
I was just going to add in, you know, we have a screening process, a check-in process, if you will, for team members when they arrive for a deployment. To ensure that they are physically fit and ready to go on a deployment. There's a very similar process for the dogs. So all the dogs are examined upon arrival at our mobilization point and are all checked out with a health check, et cetera, much the same standards that the people are before they're sent along with the task force for deployment.
Yeah, that's good to know. I was kind of wondering how that worked, because I know we have to do that with humans when they're going on a deployment.
Lori, the dogs are a lot easier.
Yeah, they don't complain as much. Other than Australian Shepherds, what are the best breeds for search dogs, and is that different than the kind of breeds that you would use for police work, if you know?
Typically, police work are Shepherds and Belgian Malinois. Not all of them, but the majority of them are. Used to be only males, but females have proven to be just as tenacious and good at their job. But you also need, for police work, a certain type of dog. So if you have a very excitable dog, it may not be the best bomb dog. You want a calmer dog for that. In urban search and rescue, I think about 80 to 85% of the search dogs are Labrador Retrievers. And then the next would be the Shepherds and the Belgian Malinois and the Dutch Shepherds. There are certainly some Australian Shepherds and even some mixed breeds, some Golden Retrievers, and a few other here and there. But Labradors are by far the more common breed in USAR.
Wow, I did not know that. And they love water. Yeah. I know that because I have one. And I can't get him out of the swimming pool. Yeah.
Now, originally, urban search and rescue was just that, urban search and rescue, your typical the World Trade Center, the Oklahoma City bombing. But we have definitely widened our missions. We have a lot of hurricanes and tornadoes, flooding. We had a little unique was the landslide in Oso, Washington, but a lot of our search areas are less in urban and more destructive in rural and suburban areas. Water search is a specialty, and water searches are by their nature human remains. So live find is the main mission for FEMA Urban Search and Rescue, but they have expanded that to where task forces can voluntarily certify human remains dog, and they can be certified for building and vehicle and water as well. That is voluntary. It's not required. So we have definitely expanded our mission capabilities, just like OSO. We had 23 dogs from 9 task forces, and I was there for 3 weeks with those guys, try to bring closure to all the families who were still looking for their lost ones.
Yeah, that was very sad. In fact, some time ago, we interviewed one of the medics that had responded to that, and it was mind-boggling, to say the least. Well, as we wind down here, I'm kind of curious, how did Dabney do in Puerto Rico with Irma and Maria?
Well, Dabney doesn't deploy with FEMA because she's not FEMA certified. So I deployed as a veterinarian.
Okay.
I deploy as a veterinarian. She is my demo dog for first day. We do some private cold cases because she is certified. I can also deploy with her with my team as a state asset. But as far as federal, she doesn't have the FEMA certification, so I deploy as a veterinarian, and I went to Irma and Maria to take care of the search dogs there.
Perfect. So as Jamie asked earlier, what kind of things, it was being a somewhat different environment, what kind of things did you see with the dogs there?
The dogs did not do a lot of search in Puerto Rico. I would say that I have seen different things in different venues. For example, OSO, there was a 10 to 30 foot feet piles of mud. There was water and there was weather. So we had a decontamination of the dogs every day. And so their injuries ranged. They would step. Their feet would step in the mud and come out bleeding because there was glass and debris that they couldn't see. So there are a lot of leg injuries. That's where we developed the bandaging. We had a lot of skin issues because of all the decontamination and the water and the moistness. I just finished a paper, which is under review for publication, for the campfire in California. They had a lot of interesting wounds as well, but the most thing they had to be careful of, the ground is hot and the air was filled with smoke. They did pretty well, though. So the environment plays a big role in the things you may see. Puerto Rico, there was certainly the heat and humidity. They did some water, but overall, the dogs did very well down there.
Wow, good to know. So just a quick question for you, Becky. How likely is it that we would have another mudslide the size of OSO? Is that really unusual, or can we expect to see more of those?
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Well, I'm not, can you refresh me on which mudslide you're referring to? I mean, I'm familiar with the campfire, but not the mudslide aspect.
Well, that was how long ago, Jamie? A couple of years now?
Oh, it's been a couple of years ago. OSO was a mudslide that occurred up in Washington State a couple of years back, Becky.
Oh,
and
yes.
It was like a whole hillside came down on the community.
Yeah, sorry, all these weather things kind of tend to run together after a while. To answer your question, Sam, I think that was pretty rare, pretty uncommon. If I recall correctly, the Pacific Northwest had kind of been under a deluge of just storm after storm after storm, which really led to that. But it can happen really. These kinds of mudslides are very common after wildfires because the ground is just all turned up and there's no trees and things to stop the water and the mud.
OSO was 2014.
Okay, yeah. That seems like it was a while ago now, but we've been doing this for 6.5 years, so you forget that those things happened and we interviewed those people so long ago. Jamie, I don't know. This is fascinating. I think all of us learned something new from Lori on, and at least for me, I have a much higher respect for those dogs and the handlers and the vets that take care of them.
Yeah, and actually, I think it's important for us to maybe, as rescuers ourselves, you know, be aware that this is a need, as Lori outlined, that there is a need for more veterinarians in the system so that they can become certified with FEMA and be available to deploy, whether for with their state resources or to certify with the federal IST resources. And you know, that's something that we can certainly put out there to our audience, that keep your eyes open, talk to your local veterinarians that you have in contact with your own personal animals and family animals, and let them know that this is something that there's a need for, because it may not be something that local veterinarians are even aware of, that's something they can do.
Right. A lot of disaster teams have been formed at veterinary colleges and universities. Like Texas A&M has a very rigorous response team, and Tufts has a small one. It doesn't have a lot of equipment, though. In many states, for example, SMART is the state of Massachusetts animal response team, made up of veterinarians and vet techs, specifically more so for the pet animals, but they're also a resource for FEMA and other state USAR teams to utilize if possible. I know that the campfire had several of those types of facilities available throughout the search area. So yes, the more people that get involved, the more resources the dogs will have. But I will caution people that they have to train for this. You don't want volunteers coming in the very first time and have them become victims themselves. They need the proper protective, personal protective equipment, the PPE. They need training in hazmat. It's not, volunteers are just a tremendous asset, but the more training they have, the better an asset they'll be in the field.
Definitely. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's important to have you on the show here, Lori, to talk about it, because when we do go out and recruit those people, it's important to bring them in through the proper channels. And whether it's through the state USAR teams or referring them to people like yourself to help connect them in with the federal resources and help them get the training they need. So when these situations happen, when disaster strikes, they can be part of the federal rollout and come in properly trained, properly vetted, and ready to lend their resources to the communities. So thank you for pointing that out, Lori. That's important. You know, Joe, I was thinking, you know, we talked just a second ago about training, but that's all part of it. And I'm curious, you know, how you talk about the use of animal trained resources and people like Lori in the training you provide with Paragon.
Well, it's certainly a piece of our scenarios in many cases. We try to emphasize many of the points that Lori pointed out, and she is very humble. But I think the other point to make in regards to the very important points that Lori made is that the canine members of the team are somewhat unique from, you know, general dog care, and there's much to learn about the very specific and unique environment these dogs work in. So in addition to the things that Lori talked about, we also need to incorporate her expertise and training into scenario management and training for folks that are considering deploying with search and rescue assets.
If someone wants to find out about what kind of things you guys do specifically at Paragon, where can they reach out to you? Where's a good place for them to get a hold of you and find out about the specific customizable resources that you all provide?
So we're always happy to talk to folks to customize an experience for them, and they can find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or through the Disaster Podcast or our Facebook page for Paragon Medical Group or the Disaster Podcast.
And we want people to reach out and take advantage of the excellent resources you all provide, and to also thank you for continuing to help bring the Disaster Podcast to the various audience members and communities that take advantage of listening to our show. So thank you again for helping us bring it the show to them. Lori, is there a place where folks can contact you or find out exactly what kind of resources and things that you make available or how you help people connect to FEMA?
The USAR Veterinary Group, my task force sponsors a website. It's usarveterinarygroup.org. It's USAR Veterinary Group, one word, .org. And they can send questions through there or just peruse the information on there. There's some medical stuff. There's decontamination stuff. There are question and answer section. So that's probably the best way to get questions to me. If someone is interested in becoming a part of a disaster response team, they can check first locally in their state. I know North Carolina, Massachusetts, and several others have veterinary and vet tech-based response teams, or perhaps work with the university in the area. And then the next step, FEMA teams, many of them are also state assets, so they can look in their own state. There's 28 teams. You can just put in FEMA USAR teams, and it'll come up with the 28 teams to see if there's one in their area, in their state. And they can campaign to get on board. Some of the task forces are, I think, would be happy to have a veterinarian on the team. Others are a little shy about it. So not all teams are the same. So you have to kind of feel out what they might be willing to accept. It is a cost to them to train somebody. And since veterinarians aren't officially on the teams, you need a team leader or a program manager that is canine friendly. not that they don't all care about the dogs, but there is some funding involved. So they stick their neck out. My task force stuck their neck out a little bit in training me, but hopefully they've been pretty happy.
Great. Well, and it's important to understand, you know, that this is something that requires some people to jump through some hoops to get the proper funding and materials and things in place. So thanks for pointing that out. That's something that we have to keep in mind. Becky, where can folks find you and get in touch with you if they want have some weather questions or want to follow the stuff that you're keeping track of?
Yeah, so I'm always talking about weather and emergency management stuff on Twitter. They can follow me at WX_Becks, BECKS. And I'm also always around the Disaster Podcast Facebook group and happy to answer any questions over there.
Yeah, and sorry I stumped you with that one question about the thing I saw on the twister-related instrumentation. So
it was totally valid. I don't know a lot about it. I'm still learning.
It's all good. But those are the kind of things we bring up on our Facebook group, and we have a lot of people with a lot of resources. You weren't able to necessarily answer, but somebody else was able to give me some information and resources to follow up on there. That was another member of our Disaster Podcast group. So it was all good. But you know, these are the types of things when you have a question, you can put it into our Disaster Podcast group and get an answer from one of the numerous well-educated members of the group out there. So it's a great resource, and I urge everybody to go over and search for Disaster Podcast on Facebook and join the group and lend your resources and lend your questions so that people can get the answers for you. But thanks, Bex. Sam, how about you? Where can folks find you?
Well, you can find me in the Facebook community. I love that group. They've been very vocal in terms of asking questions, answering questions. It's quite an international presence, so we see various sides of things. And several of them have been guests, and several of them have yet to be guests. So I love that group. We're like 650 strong right now. But other than that, you'll find me on social media under Sam Bradley or SamBradley11, and certainly on the DisasterPodcast.com website. How about you, Jamie?
Well, I can be found under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations, so search me out, friend, or follow me there, and of course at our DisasterPodcast.com site, as well as our Disaster Podcast the Facebook group. Sam, great topic for tonight. Thank you for reaching out to Lori. And Joe, thank you for connecting us with Lori. It's just great to be able to put all this together and provide this important discussion as a resource for our audience.
And Joe, say hi to Kimberly for us. I'm sorry she wasn't able to be with us, but we'll get her back.
Well, definitely do so. And Lori, thank you so very much for being on tonight. It was a wonderful podcast, and we really appreciate having you on. And thanks for your expertise and everything you do for the USAR system.
Well, it was an honor to be asked. Thank you very much for having me.
Sam, you know, it's a good topic, and, I think it's important for us to keep our animal team members in mind as we go about our responses.
Absolutely, and I've learned so much about, there's so much more to it than most people would perceive. So let's say disaster dogs are not our everyday dogs.